Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You're about to hear the story of a man named Samuel Osborne. He was born around 1833 in Virginia. He worked at Colby College in Maine, starting in 1867. He worked there for 37 years. Samuel Osborne died in 1904, just 1 year after he retired. The then president of Colby College was a pallbearer at Osborne's funeral. And now, the president's house at Colby has been renamed in Samuel Osborne's honor, which would seem befitting for, say, a longtime professor or a college administrator. But Samuel Osborne was a janitor. He was also born into slavery. Here to tell us more about Osborne's remarkable life is the current president of Colby College, David Green, and he joins us from Waterville, Maine. President Green, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
This is such an incredible and wonderful story. First of all, how did you learn about who Samuel Osborne is?
It really is a remarkable story. I'll have to say it's one that captured my heart and my imagination. I learned about it because when I first came to Colby, of course, I was devouring every piece of history I could when I came here to understand the history, the people who had been here, what had happened over time. And I came across this particular piece of history when I was working on a talk that I was going to be giving on Martin Luther King Day that year. And I came across a work that a faculty member of ours, Mark Tappan, and his students had done when they were looking at the history of social activism at Colby over time. And they had unearthed a number of interesting pieces about Sam Osborne's life. And that brought me to the archives on our campus to learn more.
Well, tell me the story briefly, if you could, about how is it that Samuel Osborne, born into slavery in Virginia, ended up working at Colby in Maine?
It's really an extraordinary story. Of course, Sam Osborne was born into slavery. His father was brought to this country forcibly on a slave ship. And he met his wife, Maria, when they were children on the same plantation, in fact. Just as the Civil War was closing in 1865, Samuel Osborne met a man from Maine, a colonel in the Union Army, who was a graduate of Colby College, and Samuel actually worked for him for a short time. And that colonel brought Samuel north to Maine and brought him to Waterville, Maine. And the president of Colby College at that time helped Samuel get a job at the railroad station nearby. And ultimately, the people of Waterville, including the folks at Colby, helped bring his entire family here.
Wow.
And Samuel ultimately, as you mentioned, became the janitor here for 37 years, following his father, in fact. His father was first hired as a janitor here, and then Samuel took over 2 years later and was here for 37 years.
So, you know, while this is a story that warms the heart, it also contains the reality of the fact that even though they had been freed from slavery, the Osbornes have. I mean, we've discovered that while Samuel Osborne was a beloved janitor at Colby, there's literature that says he still had to tirelessly endure the pranks and assaults on his intelligence from the students.
Yeah, there's irony in that as well, because by all accounts, he was extraordinarily intelligent. He had a memory that everybody commented on as being absolutely first rate. He was insightful. He never forgot the name of an alumnus or a student. So to imagine that he may have faced some derision as well, not a surprise given the time and given what a novelty he must have been and given the nature of race relations in the country at that time. But surely any of these stories, given that moment in history, they're complex.
Right. I mean, so the racism just doesn't disappear. It hasn't yet disappeared from America.
That's right. And, yeah. It's hard. I know it's hard for me to imagine, as it must be for you, what it must have been like in the 1860s for anybody coming out of slavery and then to come to Maine, where he was surely a novelty.
Well, but he made an impact on Colby, though, because I'm seeing here that when Samuel Osborne was in his deathbed, that the president then and President Mrs. White went to his bedside in the morning and remained until he passed away. Is that right?
That's my understanding as well. And in fact, on the commencement just prior to his passing, many alums came back because they had heard that he had been ill. And the students marched from their graduation to his home, each one shaking his hand and saying farewell to him at that time. So he clearly played a very special role in the lives of the students and the entire community here. And his story, every time I dig a little bit deeper, there's just these incredibly rich nuggets that show up.
Like the fact that the college bell rang 71 times representing his age when he passed away.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
I think that it's really amazing to think about the impact that he had on the lives of people here. And for me, that's one of the reasons why acknowledging that and celebrating it and making sure that we always remember that part of our history is so important.
Mm-hmm. So the story gets even better, though. I mean, we've acknowledged some dark parts, but I want to focus on the light as well, because I understand that Samuel Osborne's daughter, Marion, became a student at Colby.
He had seven children. He and his wife, Maria, had seven children. Maria, by the way, was known as Mother Osborne on campus. They had seven children, two of whom came to Colby. They had a son who came in the 1890s, and then a daughter, Marion, who came in 1896 and graduated in 1900. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from Colby. And she went on to a great career as a teacher in Brooklyn, New York, and ultimately moved back to Waterville later in life.
Wow. And do we know where the Osborne family is now?
We have not been able to find his descendants. We know where the family is buried here in those who were at the college in Waterville, but we have not been able to find descendants. But we have been able to find, interestingly, a number of people who have come forward with stories about the Osbornes through their own ancestors.
Oh, interesting. Hopefully the word can get out and the research can continue, because it would be amazing to find some of his descendants, given the impact that he's had on Colby College. President Green, there's one more question I want to ask you, because I'm thinking about Colby today, right? You've got some 2,000 students there. Is that right?
That's correct.
And about 28, less than, just under 30% students of color?
Right.
Yeah. So I just wonder, how is it that you can further use Samuel Osborne's legacy to continue to create or even better create a welcoming environment for students of color at Colby College?
Well, I think it's so important for us to recognize those who came before us and who blazed paths in whatever way that might have been. And certainly the Osborne family did that for many. When I first told this story to a group of alums and others, a gentleman who's African-American who graduated from Colby about 40 years ago came up to me and said, "I wish I had known that story when I was at Colby. I would have known at that time that I had a reason for being there and that others had gone through a lot to make sure that I could be here."
Yeah.
And I think for all of us to remember that is just essential.
Well, now the president's house is named in Samuel Osborne's honor. So is there a plaque that tells a little bit of his story or something
like that? We're working on that right now. And I want to make sure that everybody understands how important that family was, how hard they worked for us. And one of the things that we really celebrate at Colby is hard work. And that's true for every staff member here, whether they're working on the grounds or they're cleaning buildings or they're working in offices. And so I want to make sure we recognize that part of the story as well.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing that through a plaque and other ways telling the story going forward.
Well, David Green is the 20th president of Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He renamed the president's house in honor of Samuel Osborne, a janitor who worked at Colby in the late 19th century, a man who was also formerly enslaved. It's a truly remarkable story. And President Green, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Meghna, for having me on your show.
I'm hoping that along with listening to this show every day, you also listen to Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the great folks here at WBUR and our friends at the New York Times, and I happen to host that show as well. So today we want to share an excerpt from a recent episode of the podcast with you, and it begins in a hospital pediatrics wing, usually a place of pain and resilience, fear and healing. Normally, the symptoms treated there are physical. But for Thomas Hooven, the hospital became a place for a different kind of recovery. Jake Gyllenhaal reads this essay for us. He stars in the movie Stronger about Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bauman. Gyllenhaal reads Hooven's modern love essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting.
I started my pediatrics residency on the cardiology unit, which was appropriate. My heart had a giant hole in it. Just after I graduated from medical school, as I was moving into my fiancé's New York apartment, she ended our relationship. We went out to dinner that night, and after we came home, she told me we were through. She and I had been together 12 years, engaged for 2. We had a wedding planned for 3 weeks later. I can't believe you're doing this, I said from the edge of her bed. I know we'll always be best friends, she said. I left just after sunrise, suitcase in hand, feeling as if I had just fallen from a moving train. It seemed unimaginable that I was meant to report for duty at the hospital in less than a month. My new employers were expecting a freshly minted physician, full of knowledge and an eagerness to heal. As it was, I could barely remember my name. I took a cab to the airport, booked a flight to my father's house in Minnesota, and stayed there until it was time to limp back to New York to start my residency. I spent the hour that was supposed to have been our wedding ceremony sitting in the crook of a tree, staring at the suburban horizon. The evening was silent. The weather was perfect. After returning from Minnesota, I moved to a marginal block in a neighborhood of highway access ramps and overpasses. Plastic bags blew along the empty streets. Brief walks to and from the hospital and solitary meals with dust motes swirling in my sparse living room were all that interrupted the otherwise constant blur of rounding on patients in the dim morning hours, writing hundreds of medical orders, and updating parents, who ranged from frantic to silently resigned. There are rules about the number of hours a training physician can work in a hospital, but the limit remains high. 80 hours a week. When done back-to-back and filled with children suffering from complex illnesses, weeks like that tend to metastasize, leaving room for nothing else. When I started my work as a doctor, it took every bit of concentration to put aside my private sadness and focus on my patients. I was lost, and it's a wonder I didn't hurt anyone. In moments of downtime, and especially in the depths of night when the unit was quiet, memories of my ex and my longing for her would overtake me. Like a persistent virus, loneliness lived inside me. My ex and I had gone to the same high school. As two children of divorce who had been caught between battling parents, we were drawn to each other like compatriots. We held on to our young romance through 4 years at separate colleges and journeyed across the country to attend graduate school together. We seemed on the cusp of the grown-up lives we had imagined. Actually, we were about to disintegrate. As a couple, we did not fight. Our relationship was conceived from a need for security and stayed small, quiet, and safe. We came together in the disorienting haze of parental conflict, and from the start, we shared a tacit assumption that fighting meant losing love. At the end, surrounded by cardboard boxes we had spent the day hauling into her living room. I asked over and over why she was leaving me. She couldn't articulate a single reason. "I don't know," she said. After more than a decade together, that non-answer amazed me. It seemed the most brutal response possible. But now, more than 5 years later, her response seems less surprising and more diagnostic of why we failed. Our relationship had never developed the vocabulary necessary to express the many colors and intricacies of adult emotion. We had no language for negativity. She must have sensed that and realized we were headed for serious trouble. Compared with many of my patients that year, whose illnesses, complications, and treatment regimens would fill a textbook, my burden of heartache was light. Still, my patients and I inhabited a space in the city together at a time when we were suffering. The hospital is a place for that. Simultaneous suffering. I remember a 15-year-old boy with severe renal failure, tubes through his flanks draining urine directly from his ravaged kidneys. His mother rarely visited him over the many months that he spent admitted. Every night, he would mount dramatic protests about the frequent injections his disease required. One time, his howling screams summoned me to the hallway. It was after midnight. Crouched and sobbing against the wall, head buried in his palms, he looked barely older than 7. I sat on the floor next to him and put my hand on his shoulder. We stayed there for about 15 minutes, me in my scrubs, him in his thin yellow gown with clowns on it, both isolated amid the nurses, medications, and monitors. After that, he returned to his room, took the shots, and went to bed. I went back to the tiny sleeping quarters for overnight staff and traipsed into the past, scrolling through old emails from my vanished fiancé and waiting for dawn. Healing comes slowly, but it comes. A budding pediatrician must observe lives cut inexplicably short. The 14-year-old girl with cardiomyopathy who had a heart attack before my eyes and died staring at the ceiling. But I've also been privileged to witness how most gravely ill children overcome or bypass their challenges. They mature. They become wryer. They pick up idiosyncrasies. They smile despite themselves. My patients and I also healed together. For me, healing started through a desire to be a better doctor, the drive to improve my skills as a physician, to recognize diagnoses, know disease mechanisms, and determine the correct treatments, buoyed me, and eventually pulled me out of my sorrow. The long days that were at first such a Sisyphean cycle became a new refuge. For a time, the study and practice of medicine was my only and perfect partner. Sometime during my second year of residency, I emerged from the elevator to see the boy with renal failure cruising down the hallway, using the wheeled base of his IV pole as a skateboard. He had a paper airplane in his hand and tossed it as he approached, laughing as it looped past my head. He was getting better, and so was I. My ex and I are not in touch. Our relationship, so long in the making and so quick to end, was like an ornamental piece of crystal. Aesthetically pleasing, but lacking resilience, and once shattered, irrecoverable. Looking back at the various romantic and not-so-romantic dating experiences I had afterwards, it's hard to separate my growth as an emotionally conversant partner from my development as a capable physician. Both happened simultaneously and gradually, through stretches of triumph and sorrow. There were no eureka moments, and neither ever really ended. The turmoil I experienced as an intern left me with a deeper understanding of how pain works, how it feels, how it ebbs, and how it leaves you less naive. I also learned to open up to important facets of life that my previous relationship had locked out: unhappiness, uncertainty, regret. Comfort around feelings like these is crucial in both medicine and intimate relationships. It's the basis of empathy. I didn't understand that before my ex left me, and I learned it the hard way. By the time I met my wife, I was a changed man and a real doctor, and our love developed differently from any I had ever experienced before. Less like a crystal vase, more like a basketball. Our relationship is made for bouncing, for good and sometimes rough play that modern professional lives generate. We do have fights, oh yes we do, but they do not threaten our foundation. They deepen it. I would not return to those difficult and lonely days any more than I imagine my young patients, now grown, would return to the wards where I labored to keep them alive and well. But I would not choose to have avoided that experience either. I ran into the kid with renal failure on the street a while back. He was with a bunch of his pals. It had been years since he left the hospital, and frankly, I wouldn't have recognized him. He had filled out. His chronically ill little boy's face had developed into a sly, winking young man's. His skin had darkened from the sun. He was dressed in a denim jacket with a Bob Marley shirt underneath. "Doc," he called out. "Hey, Doc." We stood there talking for a few minutes, enough for me to learn he was finishing high school and doing well. Somewhere nearby, an ambulance siren wailed. I watched him walk away to rejoin his friends, and then turned to enter the children's hospital.
Jake Gyllenhaal, reading Thomas Hooven's modern love essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting. Gyllenhaal stars in the movie Stronger, about Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bauman. I hope you enjoyed this sample of Modern Love, the podcast. If you did, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Have a safe and wonderful weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.